You're listening to Crime Friction, a show about conspiracy theories.
It's always Bigfoot.
Baby Crowder's Road. And so is love. If you do, you need the one to move right. You're wearing a glove. Crime Friction.
All right, we've got a lot of great feedback from our Jaws episode. Thanks very much to everyone who wrote in or tweeted us or threw dead pigeons through our windows. That last bit probably didn't need to do that, but you know what? I buy the commitment to the craft. If you listened to the show, you will have heard some friends of mine, Alan and Chris from the Diminishing Returns podcast. They're a podcast about sequels, prequels, spin-offs, and reboots, and I really enjoy the show, so I think people should give them a listen. It's a show, they do two different kinds of show. Every other one, they do a deep dive into a franchise, whether it's, you know, like a Mission Impossible or a horror franchise or something, and they look at the sequels and talk about how they developed. And then every other episode is just a bit of goofy fun when they talk about movie news and trailers and things like that. But it's a really funny show. And on a recent episode, they also talked us up. Also on the Jaws episode, we had a news segment. I really like the idea of having a news segment. The trouble is neither of us really pay attention to the news.
Just our own news, which is fascinating.
Endlessly.
Yeah, but I did send you an article, I don't know if you got a chance to read it yet, about, it was from The Gothamist, NYPD keeps targeting immigrant delivery cyclists as opposed to the restaurants who are profiting off of them. And that certainly relates to a blog that you recently wrote, seeing the economic disparities in the UK from different viewpoints, from that of a writer, but also that of a delivery cyclist, and the type of problems that we believe as crime writers are described as working class aren't really the ones that are actually relevant to those community groups.
Yeah, I have noticed, and for the listeners, you know, disclaimer, because I work part time as a bike courier in Glasgow, which is a whole interesting experience in the winter, and winter in Glasgow is all year round. As a crime writer, I get in a lot of conversations about class, and I'm not digging anyone out. I think, you know, all opinions on this are valid, but it does seem like, I mean, firstly, I don't know these days what people are talking about when they talk about working class. You know, it feels like everyone's meaning a different thing when they use the phrase, and that there's a whole class there's a whole strata.
Yes,
I'm trying to avoid
lovely.
Using the word class from now on. There's a whole level of people who I don't think are included in that conversation. You know, and as a bike courier, on a daily basis, I'll see, you know, kitchen staff, hotel staff, cleaners, other bike couriers, the people who are really making a city go round. And they will be migrant workers. They'll be locals who've never even had an office job or, you know, have maybe dependency issues that stop them from being able to hold down even a call center job. These people aren't included, I think, in conversations about the working class. And when I'm talking to crime writers, and we all like to talk about how we write social fiction, you know, when we talk about the plight, air quotes, of the working class, again, it feels like the stories aren't about those people. The stories are about class tension higher up the scale. So yeah, that's me rambling.
Well, I think that, you know, the evolution of this class discussion has shifted without it becoming part of the discussion. For example, you know, working class would be, for a long time in America, it was factory workers. You know, it was the person who, you know, relied on temporary jobs or factory jobs, or, you know, not necessarily a 9-to-5 per se, not necessarily a steady paycheck per se. And I think that's slightly the difference. It's evolved in a way, like you talked about call center jobs, which technically, you know, might be an in-office job. But at the same time, the difference is not necessarily the location of the work or the type of work, but more the, or even actually the income level. It's more the reliance on a paycheck or the security, as I believe you pointed out, of that paycheck. So, you know, the working class might be the less secure. And I suppose in a way, you know, we do have the migrant workers and immigrant workers, but as you pointed out, the in a way, some writers fall into that as well, because there's very little security, and it is a often paycheck to paycheck profession.
Yeah, I think, and because I talked about this online a lot of the last few days, and kind of my head gets confused about who I've said to what. No, wait, about what I've said to who.
Who's on first, Jay?
No, who's on second? Don't go off on that skit, Jay. Don't go off. On
yeah,
that skit,
I know,
Jay.
Right?
So. I think for me, I'm trying to define working class in kind of with two key questions, which is security and are you selling a bit of yourself? You know, are you selling a bit of yourself to the man? And as you said in the past, working class feels like maybe it was easier to define. You were selling labor to the man, air quotes again. These days, I think, you know, call centers and retail, those are working class people, but a lot of them are also office jobs. And you're selling your labor, but you're selling your headspace rather than, you know, your muscles. You're selling your mental health rather than your physical health. And you have no job security. You know, people in call centers, in my experience, in my years on the front lines, making it sound really dramatic, of that battle, you're still thinking paycheck to paycheck. You know, you don't have what I think of as middle-class security of Armageddon doesn't happen in 3 weeks' time if you don't get your paycheck. You know, Armageddon doesn't happen if your call center pays you a week late, which I've had happen sometimes. So those are the two key things that I think of in relation to trying to define what the working class is in the modern day with the change. And I think that just that applies to the whole conversation. Just, you know, all of this needs, I think, we need to be careful about the questioning and the framing and who are we talking about when we're using certain terms.
And also why we're talking about it. You know, what's the purpose behind this definition to begin with, you know, or this goal?
Yeah, I do think this is going to be like a really scary dour bit. I do think sometimes part of the motivation for people maybe ascribing themselves a level of middle class, you know, of the whole point of going, well, I'm not working class anymore, I'm middle class, is maybe because, you know, deep down none of us really want to admit how close we are to insecure. None of us really want to think about what happens at the end of the month if that one check doesn't come through. And I think maybe, you know, sometimes ascribing ourselves a level of middle class fake security is a way of not having to think about that.
That's true. But I also think, I just think, you know, as humans, particularly as Americans, and I'm sure this applies over there as well, but we're supposed to want the next best thing. You know, we're never supposed to be satisfied. You know, the house isn't big enough. The car isn't big enough. The job isn't, you know, paying enough. Whatever it is we want, we're primed to want that bigger next best. And I think that's part of the reason why, as a country, we're so unhappy. We're not taught to be satisfied with a thing. And I think that part of that comes from that, you know, we need to work this 24/7. That's very much in the American way. If you're not working and being productive, you're a failure or lazy. And yeah. There's a lot of things to be said about, you know, taking time to be happy. And like you were saying earlier, it's the, you know, emotional and mental bandwidth that we sacrifice nowadays in pursuit of these false goals.
So in our attempt to do a news segment, we've just spent about 10 minutes talking about class. I was hoping for like an update on Bigfoot. So next time, can we have a whole segment that's just the latest Bigfoot sightings?
Absolutely.
Who do we have this week?
Lou Burney is the author of November Road, The Long and Far Away Gone, which is the winner of the Edgar Anthony Barry McCavity and ALA Awards, Whiplash River and Gunshot Straight, all from William Morrow. He's also written a collection of short stories, The Road to Bobby Joe, and his short fiction has appeared in publications such as The New Yorker, Plowshares, and the Pushcart Prize Anthology. He teaches in the MFA program at Oklahoma City University. And he's way too fancy to talk to us. Do you write with music, Lou?
Sometimes I do. I definitely did with this book because it's set in 1963, and I needed to get, that's before I was born, so I kind of really wanted to get the vibe of the time, and so I listened to a lot of stuff from the early 60s, and then eventually it kind of got narrowed down to a certain kind of vibe, and so, like, at first I listened to everything that was on the charts in 1963, and then more and more I started, like, focusing in on, like, Sam Cooke and the Chiffons, and there's some other stuff like that that was more... more what I was doing in the book itself rather than just a reflection of the time period.
Did you discover anything since this was not your era of music? Was there something that you came across that even, you know, if it didn't inspire the book or you didn't listen to it, you went, I really like this and I've never.
I don't know. I learned, I definitely got deeper into someone like Sam Cooke and some of the soul singers. Like I kind of had known their hits more than I had known the sort of the great body of work that's beneath the surface. So that was kind of cool. And then I rediscovered stuff I'd known when I was like in college. I listened to all the Atlantic Rhythm and Blues, that set that came out of like every great, you know, song. And I hadn't really listened to that in years. So it was really awesome to like, you know, listen to Ruth Brown again. Even though I knew I loved her, I just hadn't listened to her for a while.
Well, that's interesting because I'm sure that did like double duty for you. Not only did it put you in the mindset of the times, but it might have been fun if you hadn't really listened to it since, you know, you were in college to bring back. So it's evoking that time period, but also your college years and then now.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And actually the college thing is like I went to college in New Orleans and a big part of this novel set in New Orleans. So I listened to a lot of stuff like Professor Longhair, who I discovered when I was in college, you know, this great New Orleans musician and Fats Domino. And so a lot of that stuff really brought me back to my college years when that was like basically the soundtrack, you know, to all night drinking all the time.
I think it would be really fun if you put together like a playlist for the book, you know, just put it out online.
There is one.
Oh, there is one. Where do we find that, Lou?
I don't know. It's on Spotify. My publisher did one of those, and there is one on Spotify. I don't have the link at hand.
That's all right. We'll find it and put it in the show notes, won't we, Jay?
It must be interesting. I mean, as you said, writing a book from before you were born, I've tried that a couple of times and completely failed just because some part of my brain, and I guess stuff that's 20th century, it feels like I could maybe write, you know, a knight in shining armor or something in the far past, but there's something about writing from an era that's covered by pop culture but before I was born where I was butt up against that and my brain just can't do it. I can't find the voices of the characters. It doesn't feel authentic when I try it. Was it a struggle for you to find the voices and to get into the story?
Oh man, it was a catastrophic struggle. Like it took me months to sort of like find the right voice because so much like I'd write every sentence I'd write, I'd be like, no, that's too, there's an anachronism in it or more specifically, it's like the wrong rhythm or just like the wrong turn of phrase, or that's not the way, you know, they would have said it. And so it took me 3-4 months probably of reading nothing but books written 1963 or earlier, reading tons of magazines, watching movies, you know, from the early 60s to finally kind of get a feel for that voice. And then the other danger is like, you don't want to overcorrect and make it all like sound like it's someone faking the voice from 1963 where every other word is like a slang term from that era. Like, so it was like, it was, for me, it was a huge struggle. Cause voice is really important to me. Like that's how I connect with characters and stories. So when that was going wrong, everything was going wrong. And so finally I kind of figured it out. I think, you know, I hope it works, but then you're done with the novel and it's like, okay, I'm never going to write another novel set in 1963. So that sucks. But
it was a fun process. All of those really groovy terms from the 60s that you pepper into your lingo now when you're part of you. Yeah, you're that guy now.
No, I do wear clothes only made before 1963. I mean, I've become that guy. You know, dress apart from Elma. I'm kidding. I hope any of your listeners know I'm definitely kidding.
But that would be awesome, Lou. Like that would be.
It was a good year for style. It was a cool style for men in 19. I mean, you watch Mad Men, you know, and they could dress well, but I don't think I could pull it off.
Well, I mean, you have written for the New Yorker.
That's right.
Men still wore hats in '63, and I keep I have that. There's that fine line when I like wearing a hat, but I also feel like a hipster every single time that I try it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, imagine being a woman, though. I mean, hats are even less normal for us nowadays. And it was just as common, you know, your outfit included a hat for how many, you know, decades that was part of it.
Right.
And now it's like you can't, you know, you'll be really looked at like you're insane if you have on any sort of hat if you're not at a royal wedding.
Yeah, that's true. Women cannot get away with hats right now at all. And men, it's iffy.
Yeah, my hat's fantastic.
I've got
very expensive hat that we bought in New Orleans, and I can never wear it. So I can't wear it in Glasgow, you know.
What kind of hat is it?
It's,
was it like a fedora?
Yeah, it's close to a fedora. It's got a different name, but it's that basic idea.
It
was bought from the Gorin brothers. It's somewhere between the two. Because I'd love to wear a trilby, because in my head I'm Tom Waits, but I'm not Tom Waits and I can't get away with a trilby.
Oh, is that what he wears? That's a trilby? Oh, I like trilbies. Those are cool hats.
Yeah, he's got a bunch. I know way too much about Tom Waits' hats. He's got a bunch. And a lot of them are kind of beat-up felt trilbies that only work if you're Tom Waits.
No, you know, it's funny. In 63, I even put this in my book. That's when it stopped for men. Like, President Kennedy stopped wearing hats. And that was like a seismic shift in male fashion. And my character is like, stop. He's a kind of a fashion plate in New Orleans. And he stops wearing a hat because he's like, you know what? If the president of the United States doesn't have to wear a hat, neither will I. So like, it was an era for men and women both. That was like, fashion really started to change in around like 63, 64, which is kind of interesting.
Well, I mean, as far as women's fashion goes, you know, Jackie had pretty much everything to do with that. Between her and Audrey Hepburn, which was, you know, basically about the same time, and Kennedy dated both.
Yep.
Right. So, yeah.
He didn't date Audrey Hepburn. He did?
Yeah, he did.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Actually, we should list the people he didn't date.
Probably. And stretching back into the 50s as well, because that was very much a time. I know that, you know, James Dean kind of created a whole look, and then a whole generation of men kind of wanted to look that way, including Bob Dylan, who, you know, if you know kind of early Bob Dylan, he put a lot of work into wanting to kind of have a James Dean jacket and James Dean boots. But then Bob Dylan himself became this kind of iconoclastic, you know, leader of a certain kind of fashion. Mm-hmm. So it's just interesting that the whole period that it was so easy and so fast to turn like a whole generation of people onto, you know, different dress, different styles of clothes, not wearing hats.
I think part of it is and Jay and I have talked about this before, you know, celebrity now is so fleeting. Like, it's not even, you know, 15 minutes of fame. It's more like 5 seconds of fame. And so there's not that one stable icon for any period of time. You know, James Dean, although, you know, his career was fast, he was definitely, you know, around for enough time to cement that image and that thing.
Right.
Same for Hepburn, you know, Jackie O, you know, all of this, and they're there, and there would be this look or this person that you would emulate for X amount of time. And honestly, the last thing that I can think is, like, you know, when we're talking like late 90s, like Britney Spears, Spice Girls, like that's the last time that I can think of something that, you know, if you remember the original Britney Spears music video and she has the like Catholic schoolgirl outfit on, and that kind of spun that back into the popular fashion. But I can't think of, you know, and of course Madonna did, you know, quite a bit before her, but there would be that icon, everybody dressed like Madonna, you know, and now I can't think of anyone who you go, okay, this person has such a unique style that we're emulating just that. It's kind of normative, like style is broader. Like all celebrities dressed like X, as opposed to here's this new and unique, you know, nobody dressed like Madonna, you know. And then everybody did, because it was a unique and new thing.
I'm sure they exist. We're just old. We're all old.
Yeah, it's true.
We don't know what the kids are doing.
Speak for yourself. Speak for yourself.
We're so old, we might pass away during the podcast. Like if one of us just goes silent, it's over.
But Lou, I mean, speaking of how celebrities changed over the years, I mean, if you're, you know, if you're looking at 1963, and obviously there's some big icons then, you know, that your story's kind of in and around what was going on at the time. There are figures there that are still cultural icons now, whereas it feels like, you know, we don't really have as many cultural icons these days. They do come and go a lot faster. Did you notice anything while you were researching that kind of struck as what's changed, as why it is that we might have that?
And I mean, I think Chantal has a good point. You know, things are just more fractured now. Like you, there's so many different ways we get our information. I think, you know, in the 1950s and 60s, or I should say the 40s and 50s before TV really took off, you know, 90% of Americans got their style cues from movies. You know, you go to a movie and you see Humphrey Bogart and you start walking like him, you know what I mean? So, and then popular music, you know, was a kind of a distant second place, but still important. And now though, you know, it's just like, there's so many different channels and media that, I'm not sure like how, like you were saying, we're joking, like we're all old. Like I'm not on Instagram, so I don't follow or whatever you do, you know, the Kardashians. So I have no idea how influential they are to a certain segment of the population. But like in 1963, parents and children all knew about Elvis, for example, and they all knew about Sinatra. They might have different opinions about these people, or James Dean, but they were sort of a common language that everyone could share. Whereas now, things are just so fractured and scattered, which I'm not saying is a bad thing or a good thing. It just seems to be a real difference.
And coming at it from the writer point of view as well, it's these days now that it is a more fractured, and I guess, and you know, there's good and bad for that. Everyone can get what they want, as you know, and it's easier to get diversity because everyone can get what they want. But it also feels like we don't really have water cooler moments. You know, we don't have those communal experiences as much as, you know, everyone remembers where they were when X happened. Everyone remembers where they were when this show was on TV. And that's gone away a bit. And I only noticed that because the BBC in the last 6 weeks or so have had a run of really big primetime dramas that they've run on a Sunday night. And they're actually marketing it around bringing back water cooler moments. That's their whole pitch. You know, it's, mm-hmm. it's creating this thing so that people will talk about it in the workplace the next day. And that was the first time I stopped and thought, oh yeah, that went away. We don't have that.
Yeah.
Well, because with all of the ways that we can consume media, it's on demand as opposed to that shared at this point, which is why those moments, those water cooler moments, are generally now awful things. You know, where were you when X shooting happened, or where were you? Yeah. Because that's the only thing that, you know, it has an immediate consumption date.
Yeah, and that's why live sports here in America, I don't know if it's the same in Europe, but, you know, that's the only thing that makes money, really, the way it used to. And even that's slipping. But, you know, like, you know, like last night there was a one-game winner-take-all playoff between two baseball teams, and you had to watch it at the time, you know, live, or you wouldn't get the benefit of it. And that's changed with everything else, which you can DVR it, you can catch it online, you can do whatever. And so it's changed just how and when we get our information. So like the whole idea of a spoiler alert, like, you know, that didn't exist, you know, because now you have to do that. It used to be, we all experienced it together.
Well, and I think that's something that's changed. I was talking to, you know, some women who have marched in the various, you know, Me Too marches and women's rights marches and that sort of thing. And they're taking their daughters and doing all of this. And that's a culture that we haven't seen since the 60s and 70s. And that sense of, you know, we can all create our political opinion and put it somewhere online and it may or may not be consumed. But there's, again, not that sense of community or togetherness or fighting for a common cause, because we're all doing it from a different place and at a different time. And I've seen this tremendous difference and with the actual, you know, the marches, the coming together of people and sharing this moment at the same time. And it seems to be something that our culture has shifted away from, and I think to its detriment, not just, you know, marching for causes, but, you know, enjoying a thing at the same time and consuming this thing at the same time and having a shared experience is so rare. And I think it's part of our DNA to want to do that. You know, we are a group species. And I think that this isolation has, you know, brought us backwards in time as opposed to forward.
Right. Those are some deep thoughts, man. I told you it's 3 a.m. here and I've been drinking, so, you know, I need to lighten up a bit.
Sorry.
Speaking of lightening up, but Lou, you've written funnier stuff and more serious stuff. And I go back and forth because I, you know, I've got some books that are all out comedies and some books that are quite dark. And it's I can always see people trying to decide whether or not I can fit in a box that they can sell.
Yeah, right.
And I mean, it's just what's, you know, how have you got around that?
No, that's really been a central kind of preoccupation for me, because my natural, whatever you want to call it, sensibility or outlook has some humor in it. And so, like, whatever I write, it's going to have humor in it or it's not going to be me. Like, I kind of recognize that. And then the question becomes, all right, now what do I do with that? Because in the crime genre particularly, but, you know, really in any kind of fiction, comedy or humor is dangerous. Like, it's something that can really make a book harder to sell, you know, because humor is subjective and all that.
Yeah.
So for me, it was just looking at crime. I kind of was inspired by a writer, Kate Atkinson, really inspired me, because you read Case Histories, for example, which is one of my all-time favorite novels. It's her first Jackson Brody novel. And it's deep and dark as hell. And it's also hilarious. And like, I read that and I was like, the first time I read it, I didn't even notice the humor in it. And then it was the second time I realized, wow, these are really funny moments. And that kind of gave me the courage or the inspiration or the model to say, like, okay, I think I can do both. Like, I can find a way to balance it and write a serious book that also has humor in it. And that kind of became my goal, as opposed to writing a funny book with deeper themes, which does not feel like my path. I mean, that might work for somebody else, but for me, I think a serious book with some humor in it is sort of like what I aim for, basically.
Yeah, no, I think that's a perfect balance to aim for. I know I'm constantly, and I think it's got to be something that you learn over a few books, isn't it? The needle moves one way or another, and then you finally find the right spot and try and stay there. But yeah, I'm definitely, and it's because it's something that I've always been a bit confused by in the noir community is how sometimes we can make things out to be one note, one tone. You know, these stories that are kind of a race to violence or depression or anger, all of these things, and just think, but life isn't one tone. Life is funny things happening on bad days and bad things happening on funny day on good days. And you know, you've got to try and capture all of that in your fiction, I think, to be realistic.
Those are my favorite novels that are both light and dark, you know, because that is exactly what life is. And I think sometimes a writer can get pigeonholed, or you know, if a book seems, oh, that's a funny book, it can get dismissed in a way, you know, that other books that are one note maybe are not dismissed. So it's just a tricky thing. It's a great conversation. Like, I just think, you know, I love to read a bunch of different stuff. So I try to think as a writer about like people who like to just read one kind of thing, and it's hard to put yourself in that perspective sometimes, but it's a useful kind of exercise for me too. It's like, all right, how is this book going to seem to someone who only reads one kind of fiction?
Well, we were talking about that in our Jaws episode, which should be the one right before this. And when we read Jaws and then we watched the movie, and the book struck me as highly similar to Updike's Witches of Eastwick, and Jay made a connection to a Western. And I said, you know, it's funny because I'm a strong, like, genre as a marketing tool, and really doesn't, you know, necessarily define.
Right.
And it does bother me that readers, unlike moviegoers, you know, tend to stick in one genre when they could be exploring so many other things. And I won't say guarantee, but I'm going to say guarantee that somebody who enjoyed, for example, Jaws would enjoy either of the other books that we were talking about as a result, because it had similar themes and similar things, despite one being adventure, you know, horror, one being fantasy, and one being a Western. And so it's, you know, thematically,
right,
they're similar, even though, you know, genres, people would never pick up all three books, or rarely.
Like, I love crime. I love the crime genre. And there are things in that that I think are only in the crime genre that I love. But at the same time, I'm a total believer, like you are, in sort of the universal great story and great character. And that's, at the end of the day, that is going to be compelling. And, you know, and that's why I think the crime genre is so great in some ways, is because it's so expansive a genre. You know, you have so many different writers doing so many different things that it almost defies, you know, the boundaries of genre itself, which I love, you know. And so, you know, like, I guess, you know, Jaws is kind of a crime story in a lot of ways, if you think about it, just like a lot of Westerns are crime stories. And I love how, you know, it just all breaks down at some point and you're just writing, you know, a great story with great characters.
Yeah, I agree. And it did strike, I think, with Jaws, because we just noticed that stuff that I think, because it's not in the film so much, I'd completely forgotten that the book is able to deal with kind of class issues and things like that.
Right.
And crime does that brilliantly. You know, crime can get into the economics and the class and those social issues. You know, it then throws a gun or a bad guy at you rather than a shark. I make it sound like someone throws a shark at you.
No, but I totally agree with that. I totally agree with that.
Bringing back something we used to do quite well, we've got award-winning author Art Taylor and his son Dash, and they're telling us about some stuff.
Hi, I'm Art Taylor, and I'm here today with my son to review a book for you. Dashiell, can you tell us about yourself?
I am 6 years old, and I am in first grade, and I like purple, the color purple, and I like cars and stuff like that.
Yeah, there you go. So that's Dashiell. And again, I'm Art Taylor. We're here to talk about the book, The Detective of London by Robert Krauss and Bruce Krauss. It was published in 1977. That was before you were born, right, Dash?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit about this book? What happens?
Well, they lose some bones, and somebody actually stole them. And then they find them, and then they have a parade.
Okay, who finds them?
The Detective of London.
Okay, tell me a little bit about the Detective of London.
The Detective of London likes to eat snacks, and he looks like Sherlock Holmes.
He looks like Sherlock Holmes, but he's a...
dog.
Yeah, what kind of snacks does he like to eat?
He likes, hamburgers. Actually, marmalade with what?
Crumpet.
A crumpet. And he likes tea.
And fish.
Fish and hamburger?
No, fish and chips. That's good. That's
fish
close.
Fish and chips.
Yeah. Hey, let me ask this. It's Detective of London. Have you ever been to London?
No.
Would you like to go?
Yeah. And I would like to see Big Ben.
Ooh, anything else you'd like to see in London when you go?
I like to see double-decker buses and stuff like that.
Oh, that sounds like a lot of fun. All right.
Also taxis.
Oh, yeah, taxis too. All right. Well, that is The Detective of London by Robert Krauss and Bruce Krauss. And would you recommend this one to other readers?
Yeah.
All right. We both give it a 2 thumbs up recommendation. Thank you so much for being with us.
And thank you. Goodbye.
Back to Luke.
Well, now you teach at an MFA program. How does any sort of genre fiction play into your program? Because I know that I teach at several universities as well, and come up against some who really are embracing genre fiction and others who heartily reject it, to put it mildly.
Well, I'm lucky enough. I teach in a low residency MFA program, which means we actually only meet as a group twice a year for about a week each time. And the rest of the time I'm working individually with students. So basically I'll do whatever they want to do. Like each student is doing his or her own thing. And I adjust to that. Like I try to help each student accomplish what he or she wants to accomplish. So I have all kinds of genre writers. I have all kinds of mainstream fiction writers. It's whatever it is, whatever you're trying to do, I can try to help you, which is great, because when you're doing a workshop situation, sometimes with full groups meeting once a week for 13 or 14 weeks, it's trickier because you're dealing with, you know, a group and not an individual and like, all right, well, what are we going to talk about today? But I get lots of genre writers and I love that. I get a lot of people who write in genres that I'm not that familiar with. Like I get, you know, like science fiction and fantasy and romance. And I love that because then I get to brush up on that and I get to like sort of figure out like, all right, what are the conventions of the genre? What should they ignore? What should they embrace? How can they subvert it? So I'm definitely of a mind that, you know, everybody should do their own thing. And I'm there to help them do that. And I came from an MFA program myself where a couple of the professors, you know, were looked down on genre, I think, in a way that these days is less common, I hope.
Yeah.
And I definitely think it's not useful at all.
Well, and isn't it fun? I love dealing in different genres. And just like you said, you know, seeing the different conventions and also, you know, seeing that, I guess, basically spotting the overall differences and spotting the overall similarities. You know, like you said, good storytelling
right.
is good storytelling. So that's why you're able to, you know, well, A, you're smart anyway, but B, you know, speak intelligently in the genres that you're not as familiar with, because at the core, the storytelling is the same. But then you go,
yeah.
Okay, we're going to adapt this, you know, to do these certain things that you wouldn't do necessarily in another genre. I recently edited an anthology called Mystery, which was a bunch of sci-fi and fantasy writers who were instructed to write in mystery tropes. And that was fascinating to see how they adjusted or not in some cases, because, you know, it's much writing crime mystery is a bit tighter than all of the world building you get to do in sci-fi and fantasy. That would not fly
right,
in our genre.
Right.
And so it was fun to see how they'd try to, you know, still get that in there. And I'd go back with, no, cut your first two pages. We didn't need any of that. Just, you know, get in there. Which is not
yeah.
something that often happens in a sci-fi fantasy. So it's fun to see those similarities and differences, I think.
Yeah, it totally is. And you learn stuff. You get to steal stuff and like,
right?
Oh, I'm gonna use that little tactic or that little device. That will work good in my novel. So no, borrow. Sorry, not steal.
Yeah.
Just borrow. I give it back eventually.
I'm okay with admitting that I steal. It's fine. I steal all the time. Listening to the way you were talking about teaching, and you're talking about, you know, looking at the different tropes and analyzing them and how you can subvert them, and then just thinking back to, you know, we started with you talking about having to figure out a way into 1963, and I guess kind of figure out what 1963 was. And then The Long and Far Away Gone was set in the past. You know, is that just part of your writing process, is having to figure a thing out that you can to write about it?
For me, every novel is a brand new thing. Like, I got to learn to write every time. I feel like I'm just starting from scratch. It's still like being dropped into a brand new country you've never visited. You don't know the language. You don't have a map. And you know, you've got a year to find your way, you know, to all the highlights and put together, you know, a great itinerary for the next visitor or something like that. That's a terrible analogy, but
I just
feel like I start from scratch with every novel and just reinvent the wheel every time. And at first, for a long time, I just hated myself for that. I was like, you idiot, you're just so inefficient, you're a slow writer. And then finally, I just have come to kind of accept that that's who I am as a writer. Like, I'm going to be kind of slow and I'm going to have to figure things out as I go. And whether it's historical or whether it's the voices or whatever it is, there's always going to be millions of things that always feel new to me. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, or at least for me. Like, I'm just kind of accepting that and just trying to move forward as steadily as I can.
I think that's a great approach to take. I mean, for everything I do, I need each book needs to have a different voice. And sometimes I've reacted quite childishly when a publisher's wanting me to write a sequel, which that's like first world problems, isn't it? But you know,
right.
Because you're like, but no, but I've done that. I don't want to do the same voice a second time. And that's it, because I'm on a call with two people who teach, and I'm just always curious of, because I also have the thing of, if every book needs to be completely different and a completely different voice. What are the universals that I could teach someone? If every book is a completely different learning experience, what would I take from that to actually teach someone to write?
Not every different book is a different voice, or at least not for me. Like, that's the, another thing I accepted is like, you know, I've got my own voice. And at first I was like, okay, each book's got to be this completely separate thing. And now I kind of realize it's not. Like, I just sort of like, I don't mind me coming out in every book. And so this sort of the sense of humor is going to be the same in every book, or
yeah.
So the way I write descriptions, or so part of it is like reinventing the wheel every time. And part of it is for me, just letting myself be myself and not overthinking it and trying to like create something new each time in total. It's hard to explain. It sounds contradictory to what I said earlier, but part of it for this last book was just saying, you know what? I have certain male characters that could all be second cousins. They all seem a little bit alike, or that they would kind of be from the same family tree. And you know what? That's fine. Those are the kind of kind of characters I like to write and that come to me naturally. And so instead of fighting that, I'm going to just make sure that they work in this particular story. So in some ways, the voice, not of the characters, but of the author or whatever, like I think in some ways that can be, and, you know, that's the you in the book, and that doesn't necessarily have to change, you know, every novel.
Well, two things. Lou, I think you do a ton of world building considering that you are primarily a crime writer. You know, all of these things that you're talking about, setting it in the past, you know, figuring out what goes around those characters and the world that they live in, which you seem to do in every book, is definitely, you know, more of the fantasy sci-fi world building than actually comes out a lot in crime fiction. But also, you know, I think author's voice is important. And as somebody who's been an editor for many years, I know authors who say, well, they edited out my voice. And that happens sometimes. And I think it's ridiculous because first of all, you know, we're just here to enable that the image in your head is being correctly, you know, is being conveyed in the way that you want it to the reader, so that they see what you see, and to make sure that that's the image, you know, on the page. But also, you know, I read the same author's for voice, and I don't actually think that you and Jay are saying two different things, because, you know, I've read a lot of Jay's writing, and definitely Jay's in there. Whether or not he tries for a different tone, there's an underlying Jay-ness to the book, if that makes any sense.
The underlying Janus. That's his biography. The
Well, it's like, you know, yeah. Every author, every good author, I think, or every, you know, the number one thing that readers look for, editors look for, you know, publishers look for, agents look for, is that unique voice, right? So that's your author fingerprint. And mm-hmm. however you choose to do that, you know, Jay's fingerprint might be, hey, you know, I'm trying a different voice, but there's always going to be that, you know, underlying humor. There's going to be that thing that's particularly uniquely Jay, just like you have, you know, these characters who have a certain, you know, similarity to them. That's the Lou-ness of the book. That's your fingerprint. And that's why readers keep coming back. It's the people who don't have that thing, you know, I don't, soul,
right,
might be,
right,
you know,
right.
That doesn't work. That's the longevity of an author, is having that thing that people keep, you know, that's uniquely you.
Something like Life After Life is radically different than case histories in terms of structure, form, and genre, lots of stuff. But like, you read a page of that, you know who wrote it. You know, it's like,
exactly.
You know, it's a Kate Atkinson novel. And I love that about a lot of writers. I mean, that's, I don't want to oversimplify, because there's writers that don't necessarily do that. But like for me, a lot of my favorite books are like that, where I can read two pages and it might be about a completely different subject than their previous book. But like, I kind of know who wrote this.
Yeah, I do agree with that. I think, I mean, because I've managed to go, I think, like maybe four episodes without mentioning Elmore Leonard. So I can now do it again. It's like I'm rationed
out. I almost brought him up twice.
I'm rationed out now. But for me, he's the perfect cocktail of all of these ideas that might sound contradictory, but aren't, because he's got a voice. You pick up a book and you know it's him straight away. At the same time, each scene is led by the voice of a different character.
Yeah.
And he's very good at capturing the different voice. And then in the long run, if you read, you know, seven or eight Elmore Leonard novels, you start to spot that he's always addressing certain themes, and that you can go to his book for those themes.
Yeah.
Right. I totally agree. I think that's a great example.
Well, let's tell us a bit about the book then, because we've talked around it a little bit. But you know, for
give
the
give us the elevator
the listener...
pitch, Lou.
My elevator pitch. let's see. It is a November Road is a thriller and a love story. About a big city mob lieutenant who has to go on the run right after the JFK assassination because he knows too much. And it's also about a housewife in a small town in Oklahoma who takes her two little girls and leaves her husband in the wake of the JFK assassination. And the two of them eventually, their paths converge and it goes on from there.
No, I'm looking forward to reading it. But the most important question, who did kill JFK?
Well, my book proposes one possible theory, which is plausible to me after having done a lot of research, but I'm not qualified to to sort of make any kind of judgment on the various theories about what really happened. But mine is plausible.
Was it Bigfoot?
It was not Bigfoot. I can tell you that. It was not aliens. I'm not going to get on board with the alien theory either. I don't think that happened. They killed Robert Kennedy. The aliens did, but not JFK. That's a whole nother story. That's the sequel.
Kennedy versus aliens.
December
yeah,
Lane.
I like that. I like it. Yeah.
Well, I'm really glad that we got a chance to chat with the super fancy Lou Burney about, you know, deep, dark ideas and also some music. And I think that we solved a lot of the world's problems, which is really, you know, the least that we can expect from the Crime Friction podcast.
That's why people tune in.
Yeah, I know. Social justice and writing advice. And what more could we want?
Absolutely. And we only really mentioned Bigfoot once.
That's true. Yeah. And Elmore Leonard once too, so.
Bringing it back home. Okay, so people out there, if they want to either report Bigfoot sightings to us, report Elmore Leonard sightings to us, or if they want to tell us how much they loved Lou Burney's book, which is November Road, which is out right now, where can they do that?
They can find us on Twitter at DefectivesPod, or email us at crimefriction@gmail.com, and of course, always on MySpace.
I actually think probably we've got a hell of a lot of messages waiting for us on MySpace. We just never check them.
That's true. Once I invent time travel, that will be much easier.
Or we could just log in.
That seems much harder.
Anyway, thanks to Lou for coming on the show. Thanks to, I don't know, people for stuff.
Thanks, Elmore Leonard, Art Taylor, and Dash.
That's a good fix.
Also, Santa. You should thank Santa.
Right, okay. I think we need to have a conversation about Santa.
No.
That's a good ending.